A gun rights rally draws thousands to the Virginia Capitol.
No one wants another incident like the one we saw in Charlottesville in 2017.
This is The Takeaway for January 20th. I'm Arun Vanagopal in for Tanzina Vega as she begins her maternity leave. Also on the show, today is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, so we'll talk about his leadership in the civil rights movement, but how that activism placed a huge target on his back with law enforcement.
Political dissidence has always been framed as a threat to national security, but that's only because national security has been framed as protecting the interests of white supremacy.
And the third movie in the Bad Boys franchise will open next week with a new director.
Bad boys, bad boys, what you gonna do? Or what you gonna do when they come for you?
We begin in Virginia. Let's get started. Thousands of gun rights activists are in Richmond, Virginia today to rally against a series of proposed gun control laws. The rally's organizers have called for a, quote, peaceful event at Capitol Square. But some fear a repeat of the 2017 Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville that led to the death of one woman, Heather Heyer. Last week, Governor Ralph Northam declared a state of emergency amid ongoing concerns that white supremacists and militia groups would co-opt the protest.
We're seeing threats of violence. We're seeing threats of armed confrontation and assault on our Capitol. We have received credible intelligence from our law enforcement agencies that there are groups with malicious plans for the rally that is planned for Monday.
In the days leading up to the event, authorities have put in place a series of security measures, including a ban on firearms at the Capitol. And on Thursday, the FBI arrested alleged members of a neo-Nazi group they believed might incite violence at the rally. This all comes after a major shift in Virginia politics. In November, Democrats took control of both the House and Senate in Virginia, giving them full control over the state government for the first time in more than two decades, ending a long period of Republicans blocking gun reform efforts in the state. We spoke recently to Greg Schneider of The Washington Post, who covers Richmond.
One thing that was different last year was that mass shooting in Virginia Beach, coming on the heels of the national events of mass gun violence that we've seen, that really pushed the issue to the front burner in the suburbs. And it was the suburban districts that made the difference in the elections in giving Democrats majorities.
Now, Democrats are considering several gun reform measures, everything from background checks to banning weapons in public buildings, setting the stage for today's rally. For more on this, we're joined by two journalists on the ground in Richmond, Virginia. Ned Oliver, a reporter at the Virginia Mercury, and Mallory Nopain, reporter with Virginia Public Radio. Thank you both for coming on the program.
Thanks
for having us.
What have you been seeing so far?
Thousands of people. The streets are crowded with folks from all over the state and all over the country. You have a long line that formed beginning at 6 a.m. this morning, pre-dawn, to get into the Capitol Square. That's where the rally will take place, and that's the gun-free zone. So they're going through security. It's fenced in. And then outside of that fence, there are a lot more people with guns, handguns and long guns, sort of standing at attention. And then inside the actual legislative office building, there are plenty more folks who are waiting to meet with lawmakers. They wear these bright orange stickers that say guns save lives.
Ned, the organizers of the rally, Virginia Citizens Defense League, have called for a peaceful demonstration today. What can you tell us about that organization and also their role in state politics?
It's a longtime gun rights group in Virginia. I would say it's a bit more extreme than the NRA. The NRA specifically distanced itself from today's event and decided to hold their own lobby day a few days earlier. The organizer, I think, is best known nationally because he was tricked by Sacha Baron Cohen into filming a mock training video for toddlers to teach toddlers how to carry weapons.
And his name is Philip Van Cleve, a software programmer and former sheriff's deputy. What do you mean when you say that this group, the Virginia Citizens Defense League, is considered more extreme than the NRA?
Well, I mean, Van Cleve has described himself as an extremist. I think after the Sandy Hook shooting, he notably went on TV and he justified the need for assault rifles just because they're fun to shoot. He's fairly flamboyant when it comes to defending the Second Amendment.
Got it. Mallory, every year you have different groups who lobby the state capitol around this time, including these gun rights groups. What's different about this year's efforts?
Well, so every year this day is obviously it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It's a holiday, so people have off of work and they can come to the legislative session. And Virginia's legislative session is short. It's only during a certain time period. So this is one of the few holidays during that time period, which is why a lot of groups come to lobby lawmakers. This year is different because the group that Ned was just talking about has organized the rally that they organize every year, but it's gotten a lot more attention, a lot more focus on it. They were expecting a lot more people, and in the lead-up, there became fears that far-right groups, white supremacist groups would be piggybacking off of this event. And as those tensions escalated, other lobbying groups, including the pro-gun control rally that also normally happens on this day every year, have decided to cancel their events. So we're at the point where really this rally is the only thing happening in terms of lobbying efforts today, which is different.
And there's this one word that seems to be floating around a lot and adding to fears that there is a highly racialized dimension to this event, which is this word boogaloo, which apparently means among white supremacist group, sort of a coming civil war. Can you speak to that and the extent to which this rally is kind of drawing out these elements there?
Well, I mean, for instance, walking around the crowds today, you see heavily armed individuals. And then I also saw a lot of signs referencing a potential civil war, you know, claiming that if violence were to happen, it's on the governor's head or on the head of Democratic lawmakers who are passing gun control measures. Ned might have more to add there.
Yeah, there are just a number of extremely heavily armed groups. Obviously, there's a large number who are coming without guns so they can get into the gun-free zone in the center. But, I mean, I spoke to a man this morning who traveled from Buffalo, New York, where he said he owns a gun range. He carried a massive Barrett M82. It's about a 4 or 5 foot long gun with 50 caliber rifles. And he said the reason he felt compelled to come down is just because it's one of the first big movements for our times. So he thought it was important to be a part of.
And have you spoken to people who do reference the violence from Charlottesville in past years?
I have not. And it's a very different event than Charlottesville. For one, I haven't seen, and no one I work with has seen so far, a single counter-demonstrator, whereas in Charlottesville, there were very, very much two groups who came there to oppose each other. This year, it seems like it's just a range of gun activists, from the heavily armed militia types to the, you know, people who are less, you know, extreme or apt to flaunt their weapons.
Got it. Interesting, though, that counter-protesters are staying away from this event. I know also that there are citizens who've been reported to be staying away from work because they're just worried about violence breaking out. Is that something you've picked up on as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of people who are just very concerned when they see people who look like they're dressed to go to war on a battlefield wandering around the streets of Richmond, Virginia.
Ned, Democrats flipped the House and Senate in Virginia this November, which gave them full control of the state government for the first time in more than 20 years. We covered this on the show last week, but for those who don't know, what has that meant for gun rights in the state?
Well, Democrats were very clear before the election that they had a package of gun control legislation that they'd like to pass. In fact, they attempted to move that forward in the month after the mass shooting in Virginia Beach. It's fairly straightforward as far as gun legislation goes. A lot of these measures have been passed in other states. Some of them are even recommendations of the Trump administration. That would be the red flag laws that came out of his school safety commission, in which the president at various points has spoken in favor of. Other pieces of legislation that they're looking at this year include mandatory universal background checks and a ban on magazines that contain more than 10 rounds.
So the president himself is sort of supporting some of these measures, but this is also, I guess, driving a lot of alarm among gun owners, correct?
Absolutely. The red flag law, even though we've seen it adopted in states where control of the government is split between Republicans and Democrats or controlled solely by Republicans, I would say among them more controversial because lawmakers in particular, I've heard say they view it as a violation of due process to put in place measures to remove guns from someone's home before they've been formally accused of any kind of crime.
Mallory, Ned mentioned the mass shooting in Virginia Beach last May where 12 people were killed. How has the gun debate been taking shape there?
In Virginia Beach specifically, following the shooting, the conversation was whether or not to allow people to carry guns into municipal buildings, into local buildings. And that is another piece of the legislation, the package of legislation that Ned mentioned, is giving localities the power, should they choose, to ban weapons in their own municipal buildings. But Virginia Beach, just like a bunch of other localities around the state following the election of Democrats in November, went on to pass what they call Second Amendment sanctuary law. It's a symbolic measure and has been sort of the precursor leading up to this rally and this gathering momentum and energy, essentially folks stepping up and saying that they don't want lawmakers in Richmond to pass these gun control measures.
Ned, last week, several men who planned to attend today's rally were arrested. They had ties to white supremacist and militia organizations. What else do we know about them and their connection to today's rally?
We don't know a ton. My impression from reading through the records that are available and other reports, they were just hoping to use the event as an opportunity to seed chaos again, getting back to the whole concept of a boogaloo. And we've seen other reports, rumors on social media of groups that are sort of have similar aims. So far today, we haven't seen anything to that effect.
President Trump weighed in on Friday, Ned. He tweeted, "Your Second Amendment is under very serious attack in the great Commonwealth of Virginia. That's what happens when you vote for Democrats. They will take your guns away. Republicans will win Virginia in 2020. Thank you, Dems." What's been the response to his comments among the people who seem to be coming there?
I haven't heard a lot of people specifically responding to his comments, but I think he's sharing a sentiment that I've heard from them. And I've certainly seen a lot of pro-Trump signs, flags. I mean, there was an RV circling the Capitol that was just completely covered in Trump paraphernalia.
Ned Oliver is a reporter at the Virginia Mercury, and Mallory Nopain is a reporter with Virginia Public Radio. Thank you both for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank
you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Arun Vanagopal, in for Tanzina Vega. Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, on which the country celebrates the life and the legacy of one of the giants of the civil rights movement. While Dr. King is greatly admired today, he faced hatred and mistrust in his time, including from U.S. intelligence agencies. In 1963, the FBI wrote in a memo that Dr. King was, quote, dangerous and should be, quote, marked by the agency. Years of surveillance followed, with the FBI even sending Dr. King a threatening letter, apparently urging him to commit suicide. Dr. King's surveillance wasn't unique. For years, black activists had been tracked, infiltrated, and even targeted by the U.S. government, activists including Ida B. Wells, Ella Baker, and Fred Hampton. Today, the surveillance continues. In response to the Black Lives Matter movement, law enforcement stepped up its surveillance of black activists. And in 2017, 6 months into the Trump administration, the FBI circulated a secret report warning of so-called black identity extremism. Although that specific FBI designation has changed under public pressure, advocates are still worried its replacement still leads to the targeted surveillance of black activists. So here to help us break us down, all of this down, is Malkia Debbich-Cyril, founder and senior fellow at Media Justice. Malkia, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go through some history here. What did the surveillance of civil rights leaders look like in the 1960s and 70s?
Well, like you described, I mean, we had the counterintelligence program of the FBI. It started around 1956, and some say it was ended in 1971, but it wasn't ended as much as it was found out by a team of white activists that broke into some FBI offices and stole the papers, then known as the COINTELPRO papers, that outed the program. We're talking about a long history of covert operations against domestic political groups using methods at the time, such as wiretaps, discrediting, falsifying information, reading and sending mail falsely, setting up conflicts both between activists and between activists and police, often that ended up either with somebody dead or somebody in prison for the rest of their lives, false arrests and other kinds of infiltration.
So how did the FBI and law enforcement rationalize the surveillance?
Well, you know, surveillance historically has been intended to monitor dissidents and police race. So they, they rationalized it by claiming, one, that the rise of a quote-unquote black messiah, that was J. Edgar Hoover's words, would threaten the national security of the United States. In fact, political dissidents, whether you're talking about the American Indian movement, you're talking about environmental activists or others, has always been framed as a threat to national security. But that's only because national security has been framed as protecting the interests of white supremacy.
Moving up to what we're seeing today, what do we know so far about the, quote, black identity extremism label from the FBI report?
The title has changed, and now they kind of just talk about identity extremists. But part of the problem with that terminology is that it both focuses on black activists while actually denying or preventing any focus on white nationalists who are actually responsible for something like 80% of domestic terrorism in the United States. There's been some, FOIAs done both by Media Justice and the ACLU, Color of Change, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others. They found, a few things. They found out, for example, the FBI was able to alert officials about a protester's plans to travel from New York to Ferguson for a protest on Thanksgiving Day a couple years ago. And the question is, how did they know that? What techniques have they been using to monitor black activists? And one of the problems is that we don't know, right? So that's why the FOIAs are so important. And those are Freedom of Information Act requests to find out more about how this designation is affecting the surveillance of black activists.
So have there been people arrested, or have there been any other tangible consequences of the surveillance, to your knowledge?
Well, we know that one young man named Rakim Balogun was arrested in Texas. He's the first, publicly known activist to be arrested under that designation. He was arrested, on a gun charge, on a gun possession charge. But how they came to know he had a gun in his home, begs the question. He was arrested. When he was arrested, they also removed reading material from his home, reading material that would be considered, radical. That is not unprecedented, but it is unusual. So, so we have that arrest that we know for a fact was made under that designation. And then we have plenty of other arrests of black activists that were improper. The fact is, though, that these programs like counterintelligence program in the 60s are done in secret. And so we know very little about how they operate. That's part of the need to investigate.
What are black activists doing today in order to protect themselves from this sort of surveillance?
Oh, well, first of all, we understand that there's no sense of real safety. That's not really possible, particularly given the technology of the day. What folks are doing is they are, turning off their geolocation on their phones when they protest. We're becoming aware of the use of Stingray devices and protecting our phones in the ways that we can. Stingray cell site interceptors, which, monitor wide swaths of cell phone use, but the fact is, at the end of the day, the most secure community is an organized community. At the end of the day, there's very little that we can do technically to protect ourselves, but there's a lot we can do in terms of our behavior and how we organize and how we build relationships with one another. And that's kind of where we've seen the most focus and improvement.
And Malkia, real quick, do you think that these this knowledge about surveillance has kept people away, or is it actually driving recruitment to organizations that fight for black rights?
This isn't just about surveillance. It's about the fact that digital technologies have been used to increase the policing and imprisonment of black people, and that is driving recruitment like never before.
Malkia Debbidge-Cyril is the founder and executive director of the Center for Media Justice. Malkia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We We asked you how you bring the ideals that Martin Luther King Jr. stood for into your own life and community.
For Martin Luther King Day, I just try to be fair and truthful to all. And this is Al from Massachusetts.
Hi, my name is Kate, and I am calling from Cleveland, Ohio. I try to respect everyone I come across. I was raised with that belief that no person is better than others. There is no difference. We are all human beings.
This is Manal calling from West Palm, and to be honest, it's hard to forget when you are aware that there are people that feel that you don't deserve the same treatment or privileges they do just because of the color of your skin. It makes no sense to me. I mean, in the end of the day, we're just all humans.
This is Erica from Brooklyn Heights, New York. I'm a union member. I work tirelessly to promote equal rights both on and off the job, and I believe in nonviolent solutions to confrontations. That's how I bring the ideals that Martin Luther King Jr. stood for into my own life.
I'm a home inspector. I inspect quite a bit in areas that have felt the impacts of neglect and poverty. Buying a home is a dream for many of these people with limited means. But houses have been badly neglected. I bend over backwards to deliver honest reports tempered with kindness. I'm trying to be as practical and compassionate in my work as possible. I don't want them to get hurt on a deal, and I also don't want to dash their dreams. I believe MLK wanted all people treated with fairness and respect regardless of their color and many other criteria. I strive to make my corner of the world fair for all. I'm Neil Wilson in East Orange, New Jersey.
My name is Danae, and I am calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Since the 2016 election of DJT, I have been on a kindness campaign rooted in Dr. King's 1967 SCLC speech during their 11th convention. The title asks, "Where do we go from here?" His speech contains examples of 1967 social, racial, and economic injustice, eerily familiar to the 21st century. King then answers, "I have decided to stick with love, for I know that love is ultimately the only answer to mankind's problem, and I am going to talk about it everywhere I go. Some days it's easier for me to be loving and kind. Other times, evil trips up my efforts. But I look to those words of King to aid me as I embark upon the fourth year of my kindness campaign. Won't you join me?"
Please continue to call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Arun Venugopal, in for Tanzina Vega as she begins her maternity leave. And we've got one more story for you today.
Bad boys, what you gonna do? What you gonna do when they come for you? Bad boys, bad
boys. In the streaming era, Hollywood studios are really struggling to get viewers out of their homes and into theaters. But one formula is still a pretty good bet. Bring together a couple of movie stars and pull off some dramatic explosions. It's a blueprint that worked well for the Bad Boys movie franchise. The latest installment, Bad Boys for Life, finds Will Smith and Martin Lawrence once again teaming up as Miami police officers, but occasionally showing some signs of their age.
You might want to pull over for a minute. I need to tell you something.
Pull over? Are you gonna pull over?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Give me 1 second. Let me see if it's way pull over.
Way low! Marcus needs to pull over for a second! Hey, can we get a timeout?
The first two Bad Boys movies were helmed by Michael Bay, the man behind Armageddon and Transformers. This time around, the franchise keys have been handed over to some new talent.
My name is Adil El Arbi, and I'm the director of Bad Boys for Life.
Adil made the new Bad Boys with his directing partner, Bilal Fallah. And while the pair are relatively new to Hollywood, they've been working together in Belgium for years after first meeting in film school.
We would go to film school and everybody was white. Caucasian Belgian, you could say. And also, you know, the media world, the movie world, all the actors, they were, you know, we didn't have anybody that was a public figure that looked like us. So to be there in that school and being the only person of color, that was a little bit intimidating. And that's why when I found Bilal, it clicked right away.
Tanzina Vega sat down recently with Adil to talk about making the transition from Europe to Hollywood. He started off by explaining how he and Bilal were drawn into filmmaking, despite the lack of representation in Belgian cinema.
We grew up basically with American movies, with Hollywood, which was much more diverse. And you know, these were the kind of movies that we wanted to make. And luckily, when we were in film school, our teachers, who were also film directors, they pushed us to tell our stories, because these were stories that were never told before. And that's how, step by step, we started to, you know, to integrate our stories in that new version of Belgian cinema.
Your first two feature films, Black and then Gangsta, both centered around gang members in Belgium. What stories were you trying to tell that you hadn't seen in Belgian movies?
Well, in the case of Black, which was about, you know, youth gangs in Brussels, people didn't really know that they existed. People didn't really talk about it, not even in the newspapers. But it was it's still a reality of that city, of Brussels. And we just felt that stories that, you know, we related to these characters, and we knew some of these characters that had those kind of lives, whether they were friends or people of our families. We just felt that, you know, these people also deserve to have their stories told to the world. And in a world, in a Belgian cinema world, where there was never a movie with main characters that were African or Arab or any other colors than white, it was something, you know, revolutionary when we would make movies about that. And the same for Gangsta, which was about the cocaine problematic of Antwerp, a city where I'm from. Same thing, also a reality, also something that's really present, but nobody talks about it, and still it is there. So that was our, you know, our need to show the world and show Belgium that other facet of the country.
So you've made the leap from Belgium to Hollywood. How do you convince a Hollywood producer that you and Bilal are ready to be in charge of $100 million movie starring none other than the actor Will Smith?
Yeah, well, that's some crazy stuff. It's just, it was always our dream when we started to study movies. To be honest, it was not because of Belgian movies that we wanted to study that. It was because of big American Hollywood movies and Jerry Bruckheimer films. We, you know, everybody saw them in the cinema. It's the same with Will Smith. You want to make a movie with a big star. And it was like a joke. It was a dream. It was just, you know, if one day we get the ticket to go to Hollywood, let's just go for the top and ask for the craziest project ever that they would never give to us, but at least we try. And that's how, like, being really, you know, cocky and not thinking too much, we just went to Jerry and asked him right away, hey, can we do Bad Boys 3? So that's how we do it, not thinking too much and dreaming sometimes too big.
Right, but I mean, when you go from making independent films in Belgium to going to Hollywood and working with this sort of blockbuster budget and blockbuster talent, I mean, what's the learning curve there?
Well, in our case, we always made our movies in very difficult conditions, although the budgets were really, really way smaller. You know, we had to shoot them in sometimes very difficult neighborhoods, in tough conditions with mostly non-actors, which is not always easy. So let's say that we already had, some war scars. We had some battles. And that sort of convinced them that we could make movies in difficult conditions and that we were not afraid of big challenges. Of course, you go then to something that's cost like $100 million with big stars and studio, and it's something else. But at the same time, it's also a challenge. It's also going to war. And the experience that we had from guerrilla filmmaking, you could say, we used that, but on a studio level. And that helped us to survive some of the most difficult days.
Hollywood has a tendency to, as we know, allow white male directors to move from small indie films to big franchises with lots of big budgets between them. You were given that opportunity as well, but not everybody gets that opportunity. Is there something that you want to tell studio heads about giving those opportunity to women and people of color more broadly?
Yeah, I think in our case, we're not, you know, white dudes. For us, even in Belgium, there were no film directors of Moroccan or Muslim origin or whatever. So we had to break that kind of ceiling, you could say. And the fact that Jerry Bruckheimer and also Sony gave us the opportunity to give two sons of immigrants this chance is just amazing. And it just proved that, you know, Hollywood got to take chances because there's a new generation of people that tell stories in a different way and can go from really art house cinema to blockbusters. And you see that kind of change. You see more women making movies, all kind of movies, and also women from different origins. There's the same thing for us, you know. I think it's the first time that two Muslim Moroccan people from Belgium make a big blockbuster movie, and it just it makes everything more fresh, and you got to take chances because it's just going to make cinema richer, I think.
Another area that has not gotten as much attention in film has been Islamophobia. You've tried to address that in some of your previous work. Do you expect to be able to do that in Hollywood?
Well, what we try to do is for Bilal and me just to be like good examples, you could say. We are Muslims and we are proud to be Muslims, but that's also not all we are. We are also filmmakers and we love cinema. And if, you know, doing our job, making movies, if that can, you know, change the perceptions in the mind of some people that maybe, you know, might not know Muslims that well or might be afraid of them, then at least we did something, you know, we're giving a good example and it's something positive. So that's what we try to do by just doing our job the best way that we can.
Adil El Arbi is the co-director of Bad Boys for Life. Adil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's all for us today. Thanks so much for being here. Remember that you can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there, or follow us on Instagram for some behind-the-scenes action. And if you miss anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can find me at ArunNYC. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal in for Tanzina Vega. See you next time on The Takeaway.